But I want to start talking about progress. Some of you may have gone to the Aladakina, the seminal song, Progress, OES Progress. The signature event for the city of Soldotna, Progress Days. Yeah. Sort of philosopher, sociologist named Michel Foucault, French philosopher, psychologist, or sociologist, talked about what he called governmentality. The role of government is to create good citizens. And education is a key part of that. And that's where the theme of progress has been indelibly marked in our history and in the way we approach things. I like my stuff. You know, I kind of like my phone, kind of, except, you know, when it causes me to work twice as hard as I normally would work. I don't mind my car. I kind of like my house. But I am not sure about progress. I see a lot of stressed people in this world. You were stressed tonight. Should I go hear this guy talk? Or should I stay home and watch whatever's on? Whatever's on. I don't even know if it's TV anymore. Or should I, you know, fill in the blank? Stress. I see a lot of unhappy people. I see a lot of them where I teach at the college. Young people not having a clue about what they're going to do in this life and paying a lot of money for an education they don't know what they're going to do with. So I'm not convinced about progress. And, you know, it's a two-edged thing. But we have largely, as in terms of indigenous Americans, we have largely written them out of the story or given them, you know, couple of paragraphs, now let's go on to the good stuff. So the group I'm going to talk about tonight, the Dena'ina of Cook Inlet and the Mulchatna and Lake Clark area, their role in progress can be measured a different way. I believe the culture I'm going to talk about tonight was among the world's most sustainable cultures. Sustainability, another major measure of progress in a sense. What does a sustainable culture look like? And I think it's something we can use to understand our sustainability or lack thereof. So the Dena'ina culture emerges in the archaeological record about AD 1000. That does not mean that's when they appear. Before that time, they were largely nomadic caribou hunters, primarily in the Kuskokwim area. Nomadic hunters don't leave a big stamp on the landscape. A tent here, a tent there, a few artifacts, a kill site, whatever it might be, living in tents, following the herds and the seasonal round of activities, as do most nomadic hunters. About 1000 AD, either someone or some group or somehow somebody invented Eslin To, underground cold storage pits, which solved the problem of how to make salmon available this time of year, and in February and March, caught in the summer, caught in the fall. And they swept the landscape. You know, if you could do one of those computer model things where there's dots, 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 you know, there's a dot, all of a sudden, they're everywhere. Not just in Dena'ina territory, but in Otna territory too, primarily in the Upper Copper River area. They consisted of a pit, usually about that deep, sometimes less, that was dug into the gravels, always up on the high ground, never down in the low, wet areas, lined with birch bark, sown with spruce root, and the seam smeared with semi-dry fish eggs. You know, it's sticky, right? Once you probably still have it on your hands. A waterproof barrier. Then moss, sphagnum moss, dried moss, and then another layer of sown birch bark with the fish eggs. creating a waterproof thermal unit, essentially a bunny boot. Yeah? Waterproof, felt, waterproof. In that was put layers of fish, grass, fish, grass, fish, grass, fish, grass. Then the top, same thing, birch bark, moss, birch bark, and then a stake. The stake is so you can find it in February. Solving the problem of how to make this amazingly nutritious and abundant salmon available in the wintertime. Other places did use cold storage, but always in permafrost, not in the unique areas we have where we have cold, but not permafrost. So anybody, maybe, I don't know, I don't mean the wimpy permafrost we have around here. That's not real permafrost. I mean the real stuff. Back in the day, I worked on the archaeology of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, 1970-something. And we were working in an area, and the guy was diverting a stream. I'm not sure you could do that today, but, you know, it was wild and woolly times. And he had a D, what's the biggest cat?
9.
He had a D12.
Yeah.
I just made that up. He had a big cat.
That might be a 12.
He had a hell of a big cat with the big ripper blades on the back. And he's going through permafrost, and after I saw him at dinner, and so how much could you take off in one pass? He said 2 to 3 inches. So that kind of permafrost is wicked hard to dig in. So it's not the kind of thing you could use as it was here. Not permafrost, but frozen ground. Why didn't this technology develop in Southeast? Plenty of salmon in Southeast, right? But no frozen ground, or very little, let's say. Not substantial amounts. Same in the Aleutians, same in Kodiak. Lots of fish, but not enough cold. So permafrost in some areas, too warm in other areas, right here. Right here is the prime spot, Cook Inlet, the Mulchatna area, and the upper Copper River area. So that triggered a number of events. And let me, I'll come back to that in a bit. And the first thing it triggered was ways of catching large amounts of fish. So what emerged are a number of fishing techniques, the main one being a weir, so stakes in a relatively small tributary stream, like Crooked Creek or like Cold Creek, or on the Kenai River like Slycock Creek where I work, with brush woven in between so the water could pass through but the fish couldn't. The fish are then diverted into a holding pen and pitched out. So that then initiated a process. And that process involved, of course, pitching them out, cleaning them, gutting them, and then putting them in drying racks, not to dry them permanently, but to keep them semi-dry, to be put in the storage pits. And when do you do that? Obviously, when it freezes. So, what fish are you going to target? Silver salmon.
Silvers.
You're going to target the late run fish because you need to minimize the time between when you catch the fish to when you freeze it because of bacteria. I'm sure a rogue bear occasionally would get into these. I'm sure that happened, but probably not often. Worse yet, a wolverine. But worse yet, bacteria, that unseen killer. So silver salmon were the target fish. Where there were areas where the silvers were going up relatively small creeks where you could build this weir across. You can't build it across the Kenai, you can't build it across the Kasilof, you can build it across either the tributary creeks or as we have on the Kasilof, I think there's 4 areas where they're technically called a Yazoo stream. So a Yazoo stream, there's the main channel and there's the stream that comes off and then it comes back in again. So those would be the type of areas where you would target silver salmon. Not that you would not catch other salmon as well, but you would, of course, but because you're trying to minimize that time between catching and freeze up. And you overproduce. So you figure out how much fish you need. Peter Kalifornsky, who I worked with, said the amount of fish per person per day went from your wrist to the tip of your finger. He didn't say how wide and how thick, but you can kind of guess that. Minimum. That's how much you would need. Minimum fish per person per day. So you could kind of calculate that. I've done a number of calculations. So you overproduce. And you overproduce for two reasons. One, the possibility of bacteria. And the second, because this system initiated what we call in anthropology cultural complexity. The villages became more complex. The villages were made up of clans that were matrilineal, but every village was a combination of multiple clans. The males were all the members of the same clan, not the women, but the males. Their wives were members of an opposite set of clans, and the children were of the clan of their mother. You get all that? Why? And the reason is alliances. Alliances. Village A says, geez, Village B, you know, they got a good fishing spot there. We'll just take it over. Wait, my sister lives there. Or my mother lives there, or wherever. So this interlocking set of alliances had the effect of suppressing any kind of hostilities that might arise internally. Each village then consisted of this group, Ukilka is the Dena'ina term, clan helpers, and an individual called a Geshka. Geshka could be a man or a woman. So there's another element to sustainability, equitable access to power and prestige, male or female, whose job it was to sort of govern the use of the cold storage bits. In other words, he or she got to say, probably to some young kid, I always think of it as a young guy, go get X amount of fish and pass it out to whomever from the storage bit. Did I tell you about the steak? Steak's there, so you can go find them. And he would, of course, pass, you know. So the Geshka was the person in charge of the freezers. So, don't have to answer this, but anyone here ever lived, maybe college or even a younger time, maybe in a house with 3-4 other guys or other women? What's the fundamental problem? You open the refrigerator. Hey, who drank my beer? Who drank my beer? So you create a situation to solve the problem. This is my shelf. This is your shelf. This is Joe's shelf. I won't touch your shelf. You don't touch my shelf. Right? Or the sandwich or whatever it might be. Maybe you share once in a while, but not often. So, in other words, by the Geshka controlling the food sources, he or she was suppressing potential conflicts within the group. So all of this, the backstory here is sustainability. How does a system work? It's not just the fish and the other foods. Yeah, there's lots of it. But you need to have a cultural system that is going to be fair, equitable, and work in the long term. There's more. The Geshka would have a partner Geshka in another village. I don't know how far away, distant. So one we know of was a Geshka in the Tayonek area whose partner was in the Kinnick area, so that level of distance. So maybe here, Kisilov versus Kenai. So let's say bacteria gets into the storage pits, Eslin To, of the village B, we'll say, partner village B. And it would be village A, the partner, would be able to divert some of his village's food to that village because you've overproduced. And why would you do that? Because someday it might be you. Reciprocity. So a functioning system that was able to divert resources from one area to another and back again.
Hi, I'm Krista Timlin, and I support KDLL Public Radio because it offers programs with a wide range of local, statewide, national, and international information and perspectives on life today. KDLL connects me to local storytellers, innovators, and experts through shows like Kenai Garden Talk and Adventure Talks. And KDLL provides a platform for local volunteer DJs to host shows that flood my ears with great music that I won't find on a local commercial station.
So what was the village like? The villages were rather stout log houses, not unlike the log houses that were built and still are built, except not notched at the corners because no axe, at least no metal axe. So there would be a set of poles every 4 feet or so where the logs would be laid between the upright poles, probably as big as my wrist, and then tied off. So I'm tying off the poles and then another course of logs, pry open the poles, lay another course of logs in, friction fit them at the corner, and they come back in. Most about the size of your typical log cabin of 1930, although probably 10 to 15 people living in there. You say that's kind of crowded. Yeah, but indigenous people inevitably live outside, mostly. So I look around the room, I see a lot of outdoor people, you spend a lot of time outside. But you probably don't spend day after day after day after day outside. So you're really using the house to sleep and cook in bad weather. That's all you need. There's a Swedish proverb that says, there's no bad weather, only bad gear. Right? So you know, most of you know as well as I, you can spend all day outside if you know how to use the gear. And you got to know how to use the gear. Inside the house would be benches on either side. Underneath the benches about yay height, benches would be areas underneath for sleeping for the parents and the unmarried daughters on the opposite side. Young men, unmarried men, slept on top. And I'm sure warm furs, caribou furs probably, mainly. Some doll sheep fur, maybe sea otter fur, you know, actually sounds pretty delicious to me. You know, those crappy old cotton sheets don't quite make it. But they're cheap. A hearth in the middle, which consisted of a log crib filled with sand. And no chimney, of course, but a smoke hole in the roof. And by adjusting the door, you would get a draft coming up and out. I'm sure they were smoky from time to time, but yeah, so is my house. And the sand acted as a heat sink, held the heat. So even though the fire was down, there would be warmth exuding from the sand. So wood was the fuel source. The houses are spaced, usually about 50 to 100 yards apart. They're not tight little compound villages, you know, right next door. My kind of living, you know, it's how we do it in Kisilov. See your neighbor, it's time to move. But here, a different reason, wood management. 10 acres is about a sustainable woodlot. And I haven't done it yet, but someday I will, or some willing student will, and figure out what that is, and I'm pretty sure it's going to be about 10 acres because you need the heat for the fire. The hearth, I'm not sure how tall they were. We know they were about 3 or 4 feet on a side. And I don't know how tall they were, but I'm pretty sure they were hunkering height. When you're outside all day, you get a little chill, right? At least I do. So when I come in, here's the hearth. I want a hook. That's how high they were. That's scientific. So these were, what the upshoot of all of it is the villages were near fishing localities, and they were sedentary villages. Movement from nomadic to sedentary. Not that they didn't go out for other purposes. They would, just like we do. But the main village was sedentary. And were highly structured and near these underground cold storage pits. The best mapped one is by the college, not surprising. There's 100 underground cold storage pits near the college, and I think 8 houses. So that's about the size of that type of village. Here, there was one continuous village from Coal Creek to right over here. If you were to walk along that, as I was able to do in earlier times before I got worried, I was worried about getting shot. There's a house every so often. One of the largest on the Kenai Peninsula, one of the largest in Alaska. Why? Coal Creek, Crooked Creek. Two of the best salmon streams, and those Yazoo streams, those cutoff streams of the Kusilov River. Sustainable culture, sustainability. Obviously, other things were used, not just fish. I think it's in Ecclesiastes. It says you cannot live by salmon alone. Get that right?
Wrong book, but it's close.
Pretty close. What book is that? So what were the other foods? As far as meat, before, around 1900, the primary ungulate was caribou. There were little, if any, moose at that time. Many people will talk about seeing the first moose around 1900, and coyotes come in with the moose. But ungulates, caribou ungulates, and we don't find those kill sites very often. One that was found, some of you know the guy, Clark Fair, was 18, and his brother 19 or something like that, and they were just out of high school, maybe in high school, and they were hiking from Skelak to Tustamina. Imagine that today. Not many high school yeah. kids are going to hike.
Yeah.
Just the two of them, you know, no radio, no nothing. Above Tustamina Lake, near Nicanorca Mountain, just not far from where the gully for Indian Creek drops down. So you hike up there. What's that cabin up there? Emma Lake cabin, and then you keep going up. That's when it gets rough, because we were there. He found a spear point about that big. So we went back up and looked for more, but there weren't any, and there wouldn't be, because, you know, there it is. George Pollard told me that the transplanted caribou tend to spend part of their year up in that high country, so it's good caribou country. Dogs were used for caribou, and they were used for sheep, hunting dogs. Dogs were not used for traction much because, you know, 17 dogs strung out, that's for the Yukon River, or the Kuskokwim River, not for here, because we don't have that kind of trail. 3-4 dogs sometimes were used for winter trapping. Sheep were hunted, as I said, with dogs going up into the high country, usually in the fall. Fall was a very busy time of year. In addition to being the most beautiful time of the year, it was fall that was. So in addition to fishing, hunting, and berry picking, particularly all sheep hunting. And it isn't so much the meat of the doll sheep, but the horns were used for spoons, and the wool was used for a sleeping bag. Berries, as I said, were extremely important, and berries were probably stored as well in those underground cold storage pits, you know, frozen berries. Bears were hunted. The last man that I know of to kill a bear with a spear, ano a mano, hand to hand, was Pete Bobby. His daughter Helen works with us at the college. Joel Isaac walked in. He's sitting over here. He and I teach together with Helen on the nine language courses and related courses. And Joel is the language and culture director for the Kenai-Chi Indian tribe. So he showed his daughter, who was at the time 13, so this would have been in the 1950s, how to kill a bear with a spear. You get low. First you gotta get the bear to stand up. That's not hard. Then you get low. Any athletes in the room? Or should I say any former athletes in the room?
There you go.
What's your sport?
Track.
Track. So when you get down to run, 100 yard dash, you look at 100 yard dash, man. Notice I didn't say 100 meter.
Not yet. We'll do that.
You get down, right? Who else is going to jump at this?
Football.
Football? Hockey. Either one.
You got to have your athletic stance.
Like here. Right? The universal athletic stance is this, or whatever it is. Probably even true in ping pong. I don't know. Not much of a ping pong player myself. And why? Because the power's in the legs. No matter what the sport, the power is in the legs. You thrust up, you get it right here. Because these bones in the skull are the weakest. And then you get out of the way. Fast. Pete Bobby showed his daughter how to do this, not to show off, not as some test of manhood, nothing like that. A lot of accounts like this, by the way, have been misconstrued by the person doing the observation, probably because they didn't ask. He did it because the Dena'ina people have a prophecy that our current world is unsustainable, and that his daughter and his grandchildren may have to know someday how to do these various things. Taught him how to fish, taught him how to hunt with minimal stuff. He showed them how to run down a caribou and kill it with a knife. And he was in his 50s at the time. So, you know, run down and you get it right here. For the same reason, current world, unsustainable. We may need to know how to do this someday. So all of these were part of the diet, which was probably among one of the best diets in the world. I talk to people who go on, I don't know what it's called, on a meat diet. So it's like a new thing. Oh, the paleo diet. Yeah, that's one of them too. There's a lot of them. Excellent diet. If today you combine it with some potatoes and a few vegetable greens, it is absolutely the best diet in the world. Versus the diet most of us eat. We'll call it the Fred Meyer diet. A third of it's pretty good. Two-thirds of it, you know. You're hearing this from a guy who used to work at a Twinkie factory, so I know what I'm talking about. Sustainability, sedentary, techniques of food and distributing food and getting food. But that's not all. To be a truly sustainable culture, one has to have a belief system that makes it work. So what did the traditional Dena'ina belief system look like? So it's complicated, naturally. All good things are. The concept of self involved three parts. Body, same as our concept. Breath, which equates with health. And shadow spirit. Shadow spirit equates approximately with soul. So some believed that when you dreamt, your shadow spirit was leaving the body. Some could will that. So for me, it's not to ask, that's not true, is it? That's not true. The question is, does it motivate behavior? That's the question, as with all things religious. How does it motivate behavior? And how does it work in the long run, as in sustainability? When a person died, their shadow spirit was around, like gravity, you know, there, but you can't see it. I have had Denina in my office. We'll be talking, and they'll stop for a long time, like a minute, which is a long time when you're talking, right? And they would say then, we were visited by an ancestor. We were visited by an ancestor. And they may have heard something or whatever. And then they would go about talking. So that was when a person died, your shadow spirit became that ancestor spirit through a cremation. So there was a cremation that usually was several miles from a village, and that released that spirit.